Now, to go back to the West again, there are several problems involved in these barbarian kingdoms. One is the fact that they are basically tribal kingdoms. They are not nation states or nations. They are not, in fact, tied very closely to geography, and their boundaries are constantly fluctuating. They are tied to a group of persons who are united under a single leader. Now, the second problem with those states is that the Germans brought in a system of inheritance which stated that property should be divided between the sons, not going just to the elder son. And this meant, in fact, that barbarian kingdoms are apt to be split up between sons time and time again. So the great kingdom of Clovis, for instance, is split up into smaller units, Austrasia and Neustria, and Burgundy, is a third kingdom there, within what we tend to think of as France. Now, this is the line of the so-called Merovingian king. And indeed, this line gets into terrible internecine wars in the 6th, early 7th century. The wars really begin by the fact that the king of one of the states married a Visigothic princess named Brunhilde. And his brother, the head of another state, married her sister. Unfortunately, that brother had a long-standing mistress who did not like being supplanted by a queen, so she had the queen killed. Now, that upset Brunhilde, and she urged her husband to avenge the death of her sister, and that began two generations of slaughter in the Frankish kingdoms. Brunhilde, is quite a figure. She's a formidable lady who keeps those wars going. She is one time captured. She manages her escape. She continues to keep the wars going until she's into her 60s. And she is finally captured and tied to wild horses and dragged to her death, which does sort of tame things down for a while there. On the other hand, by the time you get into the 8th century, the kings of these Frankish kingdoms have become puppet kings. The French term is roi feignant, which means feigned or not real kings. Indeed, the powers are the so-called mayors of the palace, and they're the persons who wield the power. The kings are simply puppets who let their hair grow long and are carted around in carts from one manor or villa to another. And finally, it is our old friend Pepin, whom we met down in Italy, who first asks the Pope whether the title should not belong to the man who wields the power. And the Pope says yes. So the last of the Merovingian kings has his hair cut short, is sent to a monastery, and Pepin, the third mayor of the palace, becomes Pepin, the first king of the Franks. Now, this indeed, because he's a strong man, gets the Frankish kingdom together again. And indeed, the same trouble comes up very promptly. He has two sons, Charles and Carloman, and on his death, the kingdom is again divided into two parts. Now, those brothers have the usual sibling rivalries that go with this period, and they hate each other like poison. But fortunately, Carloman dies off young. Naturally. And everything is inherited by his brother Charles. Now, that Charles will become Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, coming into his possession around 770 A.D. Now, while this has been going on the continent, over on the island of Britain, there have also been troubles. The last Roman legions were removed and Britain was subjected to constant invasion by people from Scandinavia, the Saxons, the Angles, and the Jutes. And they moved in larger quantities, and they drove the native Celtic peoples back to the fringes, to what has sometimes been called the lunatic fringes, which is Devon and Cornwall, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. It's perfectly all right. I can call it the lunatic fringe because my ancestry happens to be totally Devon, Welsh, Scotch, and Irish. I'm thoroughly lunatic fringe. And the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes now establish, again, tribal kingdoms there. In fact, they established 7 of them in the area of England. These are all small tribal kingdoms. And they are still pagan. Now, slavery is still in operation. And one of the favorite breeding grounds to take slaves and sell them was England. And so a number of Angles, in fact, landed down in the slave market in Rome, where they were noticed by Pope Gregory the Great. And Pope Gregory asked who these blonde people were, and he was told they were Angles. And he made that famous silly phrase, non angli sed angeli, not Angles but angels, and decided they must be Christianized. So he sent St. Augustine. Now, this is not the St. Augustine you have met already. This is a lesser figure. Over to be a missionary to the Anglo-Saxons. And St. Augustine, indeed, set out on his travels, but he didn't really want to go. So he traveled more and more and more slowly, stopping off sometimes for a week here, a month there, 6 months here. Finally decided he didn't really want to go. And the Pope sent him word that he damn well better get there. So he went. And you began then in the 6th century the conversion in southern England of the Anglo-Saxons to Christianity. Now what the Pope didn't know was that in fact Christianity had survived in the Western Islands, but in, of all places, Ireland. St. Patrick had carried Christianity to the Irish in the 5th century, the late 5th century. There is a St. Patrick, but I believe he did not really drive the snakes out of Ireland. And since his day is coming up very, very shortly, he deserves a kind of special note today. St. Patrick managed to Christianize the Irish, and he brought with him books and a good deal of learning. And the rather extraordinary factor is that in the 6th and 7th centuries, indeed into the 8th century, perhaps the best learner of all of Western Europe was in Ireland. Ireland retained its knowledge of Latin. It also retained some knowledge of Greek. But the Christian church there was basically cut off from any knowledge of what was going on in Western Europe. So it grew up according to its own customs, and they were slightly different from those of the Orthodox Church. But you had all kinds of monasteries established in Ireland. You had bishops, and you had abbots, and you had an extraordinarily brilliant kind of Celtic cultural efflorescence going on. Notably, the books produced, the Bibles produced there, are among some of the most beautiful manuscripts that were ever written in the West. The goldsmith and silversmith work was extraordinarily brilliant and beautiful. A few examples of it still remain. And certainly, learning was at a peak. They cherished books to an extreme degree. There is indeed an instance where an abbot borrowed a book from a bishop and took it off to his monastery, and as so often happens from libraries, the book was not returned. And when the bishop asked for it and didn't get it back, he raised an army and went after it and sold it. Now, our library would only do that. Simplify life a great deal. But certainly the Irish were extraordinary. And while St. Augustine is trying to Christianize Anglo-Saxons down in Kent, the Irish are in fact moving into Scotland. Via the holy island of Iona, St. Columba then brings Christianity to Scotland, and he does it forcibly and well, and begins bringing Christianity down into England from the north. Indeed, eventually, Orthodox Christianity and Irish Christianity will meet head-on up in the kingdom in northern England, where the king will indeed listen to both sides, and he finally will make a decision in favor of Orthodox Christianity. And so the Irish Church is finally brought into Orthodox Christianity. The things that varied were mainly such things as, how do you determine the date for Easter? It seems to me to be difficult even now. Such things as a monkish tonsure. The Romans, of course, had a little bald spot that was round on top. The monks had a kind of crescent shaped one that ran sort of ear to ear. The Romans thought that was barbaric. But they learned to do better. But the Irish did not stop at this point. The Irish, indeed, then sent missionaries over to the pagans in Germany, and the great Christianization of Germany is begun by the Irish. They are the ones who bring it to the German tribes. They don't even stop there. The Irish go down and found monasteries in Switzerland, a very famous one in St. Gall, and they even marched down into North Italy and found an Irish monastery down there. Indeed, they are among the most assiduous missionaries of this whole part of the Middle Ages. It is indeed an extraordinarily brilliant period, and wherever they go, in fact, they take their artistic styles and culture with them. So they are an important addition into this early medieval blend. Now, to go back to France again, we had Charles take over, or Charlemagne, I'll call him from now on. And Charlemagne is going to be one of the great and the strong rulers of history. Charlemagne sets out to get the territory we would call France in order, to get it organized and running, and then he sets out on a series of conquests. Notably, he attacks that old tribe of Avars. This is the same tribe that had once laid siege to Constantinople, you remember. And he defeats them absolutely, and takes an enormous treasure. He conquers Bavaria, the area we would call southern Germany today, and then into northern Germany, and the area of Saxony, and into the section we would today call Czechoslovakia. He also takes over all of Switzerland. He totally conquers the Lombards down in North Italy, destroys the old Lombard kingdom, and has himself crowned king of Italy. And he also then goes down into Spain, where he crosses the Pyrenees and establishes a Frankish march. Border lands that are troubled lands are called marcher lands or marches in this period. And this is the territory around Barcelona today that is taken over also by Charlemagne. That is the army, incidentally, which is caught when it's going back to France, not by the Saracens, but by local tribes who wipe out the rear guard of that army. And that is going to give rise to that great medieval epic, the Song of Roland, which deals with this particular event. So the Charlemagne is a major conqueror. And it is notable that Charlemagne is also an extremely effective ruler. Charlemagne belongs to a period when the armies are now primarily made up of heavily armed knights. In other words, cavalry has become the main striking force. And this is due to the fact that at long last, Western Europe has learned what a stirrup is. Up to this time, all horses were ridden bareback. Now, the problem with riding bareback is that the only weapon you can use from this is a light bow. You cannot use a spear or a lance, because, of course, if you hit anything with this, what happens is you fall off the horse. So it isn't until stirrups are invented. They're brought through from China, incidentally. That knowledge filters to the West, that the heavy armed knight can come into being. Now, this is important because the heavy armed knight replaces infantry. The foot soldier is no longer of major importance. But any ruler has got to have a large supply of heavy armed knights that he can call on for his war. And Charlemagne arranges this, indeed, by establishing or furthering, because it's already nascently present, what is the beginning of a feudal system. In other words, with this vast territory of his, he now subdivides this into areas, and he gives them out to persons on whom he can depend. Leaders who are called dukes, and if they are given control of frontier territories or marches, they are called marquises, and our term marquis or marquis comes from marcher lands. The lesser figures are counts. Now, all of these are given agricultural domains, which we call manors, M-A-N-O-R-S. And this is to sustain them. In return for being given these lands, they guarantee to furnish armed troops to their overlord. So the whole feudal system is, in other words, based on a contract system. I give you lands, you promise support in terms of so many armed knights. And this then splits up the territory. Now, all kinds of jobs are delegated to these lords. Justice as a whole is in their hands, and a whole series of other rights. However, Charlemagne does not depend totally on that. He also has a series of court persons whom he sends out throughout the domain to make sure that there are no injustices. And if they come across injustices, they report back to Charlemagne, and he makes amends for these. In other words, he keeps a kind of double check on all of these persons in control. He is, in fact, keeping a surprisingly tight hand on the entire government here. There are still taxes raised, but most of his personal income comes from the agricultural lands which he owns personally. These are the imperial estates or domains, and they will be under the hands of stewards. Now, since this is the case, and cities simply do not exist as viable elements in this society, the court also tends to be peripatetic, that is, to move from one place to another. And so do the counts, the dukes, and the marquises, and so on, all move. This is because transportation is dreadful. The road system has broken down totally. Bridges have broken down totally. There is literally no way to get around easily. And the result is that it is far easier to go to the food than to bring the food to you. And this is what they do. Because each one of these agricultural estates raises enough food to support the persons who live on it with a surplus. So that when Charlemagne goes to one of his manors, he goes with court officials, and they settle down and eat up the surplus. Then they get on their horses and go to the next one and eat up the surplus there. This is one of the reasons you have these courts that keep moving around. Now, it is true that eventually Charlemagne will take over one city, Acre, which is in on the French side of the Rhine, but in Germany today. And here he establishes what is his primary capital city. But even so, he is away from it much of the time every year. So it is not a permanent residence in this effect. Nonetheless, In this city, he does establish something of a permanent court. And it is here, in fact, that he starts the great revival of learning in the West. Because Charlemagne not only interests himself in justice, in expanding the empire, but also in improving the culture of the entire era. Now, everything had fallen into terrible decay. And when he wanted to found a palace school, it is notable that he went to England for an Anglo-Irish scholar to found and head that school. This is a man called Alcuin, A-L-C-U-I-N. And Alcuin is brought over to Aachen, and indeed, Charlemagne will gather scholars from wherever he can find them. He brings one up from Lombardy, for instance. Peter the Lombard is at his court. There's another little man who's almost a dwarf called Einhard, who writes the famous Life of Charlemagne. There, a whole series of these scholars are brought together. And one of the things that they try to do is to improve the system of writing. Writing had become practically illegible by this time. Not only was it ungrammatical, it was hideously written. And they developed a new style of writing called the Carolingian minuscule, small letters with capital letters. And in fact, that is our basic form of writing, which is invented at the court of Charlemagne. So they begin to produce books, new books, history works, theological works, and the arts are increased. Indeed, Charlemagne himself encourages this. He cannot read and write himself. He doesn't know how. But he does try periodically to learn, and according to the story of his life, he even slept with a piece of chalk and a slate under his pillow, what seems to have been a very early attempt at learning while asleep, and it seems not to have worked for him either. Nonetheless, it does demonstrate his interest in this. Also, of course, one of the very central factors in Charlemagne's reign occurs on the one date in history you are never allowed to forget. If you can't remember this one, I think you must get right out of the university. The date is Christmas Day 800. Now, if you can't remember Christmas Day 800, you're in a tough position. This is the day that he has conquered Italy, and he is down in Rome. And he goes to celebration in Church of Old St. Peter. And if we are going to believe the contemporary chronicles, much to his surprise, at the end of the services, the Pope simply comes over and crowns him Roman Emperor. Now, one may perhaps doubt that he's taken all that much by astonishment with this. Nonetheless, it is the beginning of a long-lived institution called the Holy Roman Empire to separate it from the old Roman Empire. Indeed, probably the Pope, and almost certainly Charlemagne, thought that what they were doing was really reviving the old-time Roman Empire. That, somewhere along the line, had actually died. And so what they start is, in fact, a new institution. And you will note that he receives the crown from the papacy. It is given by the representative of God, hence the term holy for this. And Charlemagne indeed wants to think of himself as belonging to the old line of the empire. It is notable that up in his capital city of Aachen, he builds a court chapel. That chapel still exists today, in fact. And the chapel is as close a copy of the court chapel at Ravenna as he can build. It is a cruder copy, both in building technique and in terms of interior space. But it was decorated with mosaics, some of which survive. Charlemagne's own throne still stands there. And He seems indeed by this to be placing himself as a successor to the Byzantine governors of Ravenna. It's notable that he also carries up, and there's a forecourt originally in front of this chapel where you could have meetings of the knights and the emperor would address them from the balcony of the chapel. And in the center of this, he put up an equestrian bronze statue of Theodoric the Ostrogoth. Now, this means that he conceives of himself as, in fact, being a barbarian imperial successor, both to Theodoric the Ostrogoth, who had taken over the Roman Empire, and to the Byzantine governors also. So that he sees himself in a logical succession going back to the past. And this is part of this very haunting process in this period, whereby none of them are really sure that you can't breathe life back into the Roman Empire. This is what they all want, is a return to that kind of stability, this kind of peace, the kind of wealth, commerce, industry, all of this that the Roman Empire represents for them. It was, of course, impossible by now. There is no turning the clock back. You can't return to the past, no matter how much Ronald Reagan wants it. The result, of course, was that they were busy founding something new. The empire, of course, is a barbarian one. It is Frankish. It is unconnected now, basically, with that old Roman Empire. Certainly, Charlemagne himself hoped that this would continue. And he has only one son himself. This is a man called Louis the Pious, primarily because the only thing he seems to have been distinguished for was piety. And unfortunately, Louis the Pious has three sons by his first wife. And so we get right back in the old Germanic problem that when he dies, he divides up the empire. The sons rearrange his division, I must say. But in 843, you have one of the critical divisions of Charlemagne's old empire. It's split into three basic parts by a so-called Treaty of Verdun, 843. Now, one part goes to a son called Charles the Bald, and he takes over what is going to basically be France, not including anything like all of the France we know today, but nonetheless, it's the beginnings of this. Another son called Louis the German takes over what is going to become Germany. But the eldest son is named Lothair, L-O-T-H-A-I-R. And Lothair is given a kind of extraordinary piece of land, which includes North Italy, or the Kingdom of Italy, Switzerland, the whole Rhone Valley of eastern France, and right down the Rhine River to what would today be Belgium and Holland. In other words, an enormously long, odd piece of territory between France on the one side and Germany on the north. Lotharingia comes right down through this. And one of the reasons for this particular division was that they were trying to work out a system whereby each one of these territories would have in it all the things that you really wanted and needed for a decent life. And this, of course, includes vineyards. And that is why Germany, in one point, extended over to the south side of the Rhine River, where there were some good vineyards for white wine. The importance of this particular division, however, lies in the fact that we have had over 1,000 years of trouble out of that particular division. It is the most fateful division of landed territory, I think, that I know of in history. Because, of course, what is going to happen is that you will get France growing into a state, Germany growing into a state, and that Middle Kingdom, so-called, of Lothair, shrinking and breaking up, and being the territory the other two are going to fight for from 900 until 1946, and certainly that war is probably not over yet. In other words, you have 1,000 years of dispute over what was Lothair's territory. That is in itself a very fateful division. The other thing that's notable about the Treaty of Verdun in 843 is the fact that the brothers swore particular oaths to each other to abide by this treaty. And this is the earliest instance we have surviving of vernacular language. In other words, the kind of language which is going to become French in time and that will develop into German.
Latin.
This is the language that is generally spoken, and then each little territory or subdivision speaks a dialect all its own. And that will go on for 1,000 years also. So that you do not have uniform languages. It is only Latin, the language of educated persons, which is a kind of pass throughout all of Western Europe. You can use it anywhere. Everything is taught in this. All things are written in Latin. And indeed, let me point out that there's a certain amount of internationalism that goes with this age. There are closer ties between the various classes in any one of these areas and any other area than there are between one whole group and another. In other words, the nobility of the Franks or of the Visigoths or of the Lombards or of the Saxons indeed speak the same language and understand each other, and their interests are basically the same. The peasants indeed form another whole class. Basically, there isn't such a thing as a middle class, but you do have a great church structure, and indeed, churchmen move very easily because of their Latin from any one country to another. Now, it's not an age that sees a lot of travel. If you're born in Santa Monica, you will live and die in Santa Monica and you will die. If you are born in Burbank, you will never reach Santa Monica, most likely. People just stay very much set. There is relatively little travel, and international trade has dropped down to basically luxury goods. Only the most important items, gold, silver, a few spices, silks, things of this nature are traded. It isn't worthwhile to try to carry anything else, because travel is too long and too dangerous. Goods that will spoil cannot be carried and traded at this particular time. There are too many taxes, too many problems. So that everything becomes isolated. Indeed, I suppose the best historian, in terms of understanding what history is about of this particular Dark Ages, is an English monk called the Venerable Bede, lives up in northern England, in Northumberland. Now, he avidly collected all the information that he could about all of England. He writes the famous Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, about church history, all of these factors. And yet, in his own lifetime, he never got further than 17 miles away from the place he was born. And this is going to be fairly typical. He would depend on travelers. It's true that the abbot of his monastery, or one of them he's connected with, does take a very venturesome, very long trip to Rome to buy books for the monastery. Now, that takes several years, but he comes back with a number of books, which really revs up the value of that library. Remember that a major library is going to have perhaps 40 books in it, that this is the kind of thing we're talking about. That indeed you could read everything that was available within 100 miles around. if you could read at the age of 10, you could have finished reading everything by the age of 12. And from there on, you're on your own. This is the kind of world we're talking about. The things to be known are simply that limited. So it has, of course, been called the Dark Ages. It's called the Dark Ages not because life was more terrible than it was apt to be at other times, but simply because there are fewer records, and as a whole, we know less about them than we do about other ages. But in fact, we know more and more about them constantly. So light creeps into the Dark Ages willy-nilly, and proper medievalists will, of course, loathe the use of that term absolutely. It does hang on, however. And if not dark, at least they are crude. You must not think in this age of the nobility living off the sweat of the peasants in some grandeur. There is no grandeur for anybody. A castle is a log cabin. That's about all it is in this period. Few of them are built of stone, only the grandest. And the grand stone ones have two rooms at best. That's all. Indeed, since there is no adequate way of heating them, you don't have fireplaces as yet. What you do is build a fire in the middle of the stone floor, and it does get kind of sooty around the entire place. There is no glass for windows. You simply have shutters that you close in. It's quite a simple life. When the sun comes up, you get up. When it goes down, you go to bed. It's just like that. And everybody works. There is no leisure time. You have the lords and so on are basically soldiers. They must train, they must prepare, they must take care of things. A countess or a duchess is going to be busy weaving cloth, directing the household and the cooking. She will be involved in all kinds of simply keeping her husband and children dressed. They have to make all their clothes, remember, and so on. It is not a leisure time here. You would not have been able to live, I would guess, for 3 days under these conditions. The food is horrid. Largely meats and a few vegetables, but large masses of meat, which is going to be cooked poorly and unseasoned as a whole, except for salt. And in the summertime, remember, there are no refrigerators, so the meat has a tendency to get very, very high. This is one reason why they try to get pepper as much as possible, because when the meat is spoiled, a lot of pepper on it makes it taste better. This is the kind of living condition you are in. So that it is a somewhat grim world, and it's going to continue to be through these centuries. Moreover, the time of troubles for Western Europe isn't over yet. Even after we have the Treaty of Verdun, what happens next is fresh disaster. Coming out of the steppes of Central Asia one more time comes a great tribe called the Magyars. Now, the Magyars are going to sweep on vast invasions across Russia, the Hungarian plains, across Austria, down the Danube and Rhine rivers. They will strike into Germany and down into France itself. They're not going to be Christianized. They'll be pagans. And they will loot and burn and destroy, particularly, of course, monasteries. That's where most of the things worth looting were. So they are looting these constantly. Eventually, they will be driven back, and they will settle down in the plains of Hungary. They will become Christianized, and they are the basic stock of many of the Hungarians today. Now, that's one set of invasions coming out of the east. The Scandinavians are not through with us yet. The Scandinavians are still having an enormous population burst. It's true the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes have taken over in England, but new waves come up. Now, these are, of course, the people we call the Vikings. and the Vikings with their long boats will come out almost every summer. And the first Viking invasions are very long voyages. They were usually, in this time, undertaken by teenagers, juvenile delinquents, so to speak, who set out on these, and they set out, in fact, to make their fortunes by raiding and plundering. They man the long boats, and of course, these go easily up rivers, so that they come down and they strike now into the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms and raid them. They also will go up the French rivers, up the Seine, the Loire, the Garonne, all of these, plundering and looting as they go. They will get up as far as the small town of Paris, which exists totally on that island in the river, but it will be attacked by the Vikings. They will raid into Spain. They will get down into the Mediterranean, along the Mediterranean coast. They will raid Sicily, southern France, even into the eastern Mediterranean. Now, these are long journeys. These are journeys in which they're going to be away, in fact, for several years, very frequently, on these elaborate plundering and looting raids of theirs. Eventually, of course, they will return home with their loot. The concept being that once they return home with their loot, they will then marry and settle down to a ripe middle age, by, let us say, the age of 22 or something like this, and they will set up their farms, their homesteads, and so on there, so that you have this constant plundering going on in almost every part of Western Europe. It's subjected to these consistent raids, and for a long time, they are going to be just raids. Eventually, by the 10th century, the Vikings will decide that these lands are perhaps more attractive than Sweden or Norway. There's something nice about France and England. So they begin now to establish themselves, to take over control. The Danes will move into England and will take over much of northern and eastern England, the so-called Danelaw. And they will also move in the 10th century into France, where they will eventually, by the French king, be given a territory to rule subject to him. And this is, of course, the great province of Normandy. It is named after them. The Northmans are the Normande to the French. So Normandy is their territory. By the 11th century, they will be moving down into the Mediterranean. And in the Mediterranean, they will take over control of the island of Sicily. They'll capture it back from the Arabs. And they will also take over all of southern Italy and create a spectacularly rich and prosperous Norman kingdom that includes Sicily and southern Italy. They will also have designs on attacking Constantinople, as almost everyone in this age does. It's the best place to loot that is left. So that though they look at it, they're not going to be successful, really, in taking that. Nonetheless, this extraordinary expansion out of Scandinavia is one of the factors of this period. And of course, the expansion is not limited to this. They discover Iceland, they move from Iceland to Greenland, and presumably to Vinland also, in spite of the fact that the famous map has now been proved to be a forgery. There's pretty good reason to believe that they did discover America. On the other hand, you must remember that as far as the Irish go, St. Brendan, a fine Irish gentleman, sailed out in his little skin boat, his carrack, and discovered St. Brendan's Isle and America also. There are a whole series of claimants to the discovery of America, but since St. Brendan never came home to Ireland, it's hard to be sure that he managed it. But certainly, St. Brendan's Isle appeared on many an early map of the Atlantic. Has mysteriously disappeared since, however. So that there is expansion to the west, as well as this constant raiding and final expansion into Europe. It means basically, in fact, that Europe is going to be held in a state of uproar right through a major part of the 10th century also. Europe simply will not have settled down, and there will not be any major population growth, though there will be a slow growth going on through this period. It will remain agricultural. It will increasingly solidify the feudal system and organize it more closely. So this will become the basic social economic pattern for this particular.